and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast with me, your host, Spencer. And, well, this guy, he's never going to dance again because his guilty feet have got no rhythm. He's Joel.
That's actually true. That's actually heartbreakingly true.
Yeah, you know what your feet did.
Yeah, I can't really talk about that on this podcast. You got to do After Dark version or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff Goldblum's wife will never forgive you.
Jeff Goldblum's wife will never forgive me.
You know what you did.
The hell are you talking about?
You know what you did? I'm not going to say.
No, I don't think I've ever seen a movie where Jeff Goldblum was married.
I mean, his wife in real life that he has a baby with.
Oh, he has a wife in real
life? Yeah, she's like half his age.
Oh, he has a baby?
Yeah, he's a daddy at like 50.
Oh.
Yeah, his wife is like an ex-gymnast, Olympian lady or something.
Oh, and he has foot sex with her? That's weird.
Probably. It's Jeff Goldblum. He can do anything.
Yeah.
Okay, so on this episode, we're going to talk about, so this is the first part of the 1975 pairing, which will be, this episode is Dersu Uzala, that's a Kurosawa film, and the non-Kurosawa film is Sandokan number 8.
Shouldn't it be called the 1975? Since Sandokan is from 1974.
I've seen different dates listed, so I'm not sure on the date exactly.
I have only seen one date listed.
I've seen about two or three sites. I've seen it in both ways. I'm not sure which is real.
Let's call the director of that film and see what they have to say.
Well, this is good trivia up top. Both were nominated for the Oscar for Best Foreign Film in 1976.
Yeah, well, that leads at least some American credence to that particular.
Guess which movie? Guess
date.
Which movie won?
A foreign movie from 1975.
Yeah, which won the Oscar between those two movies?
Oh, Dersu Uzala.
And it was the Russian entry, not Japanese.
Of course, it's not a Japanese movie. Yeah. In fact, nobody speaks Japanese in the movie.
Yeah, I found it strange that it's Kurosawa. But then again, it was Soviet produced, so it makes sense.
Yeah, and at least according to the Wikipedia article, he has an excuse for having worked the way that he ended up doing it.
You mean Kurosawa? Yeah,
yes.
Because Toho refused to make anything with him again. Because Redbeard and Dodeskaden were huge failures in the box office and critics, and no one wanted to work with them. So he
attempted suicide.
In December 22nd, 1971. Then after that, he kind of recovered. Once he recovered, he tried to get this movie made. So he went to the Soviet Union. Because they were willing to, you know, put money up for him to make movies again.
Yeah, and I see. At least I read somewhere that they were looking to get somebody who was more well known to do a movie because Russian audiences weren't responding to stuff being made within the state. Mm.
Yeah,
the state of Russia.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, the USSR, if you want to be correct.
Oh, yes, yes, of course.
But this was not the... not sure if you did any research, but Dersu Uzala was based off a book, a memoir.
Yeah, I saw
that. Yeah, the captain in the movie, Vladimir Arseniev? It's not Arsenio, it's...
It's Arseniev.
That's it.
I'm not going to try to pronounce any of those names. I'm going to call him the captain, Capitan, and the other one is Dersu.
Well, the dub version says Dersu. like the German word for masculine, the, der.
That's it.
Cause,
yeah, the non-version is Dersu.
Oh, okay.
And he's like, Capitan.
Yeah, and this is not the first time this book was made into a movie. In 1961, it was the debut film of a Russian director. I have his name written down somewhere.
Mitch.
Agassi Babayan.
Yes, there it is. Agassi Babayan.
And
yeah.
I tried to look for it, but I couldn't find it cheaply in soon enough time, so didn't watch it. But it's like his is only like an hour long or something. It's much shorter.
You know, I recently had to try to find a copy of a Russian movie from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And you're either going to get a really bad dubbed version or you're going to get just a really bad, you know, non-dubbed version that you can't find subtitles for. Mm. That's like, it's kind of difficult. I wonder if those things are even archived anywhere.
Yeah, I guess if it's like Tarkovsky, it's archived. If it's not, it's kind of thrown aside.
Yeah, if it's critically acclaimed and up for awards and stuff like that, yeah, just like anything else, you're usually going to find a copy. But I imagine that the most Russian films that didn't end up like that probably just ended up on from film to tape reels, and then from tape for national TV ended up, you know, whatever, in a basement somewhere that flooded.
Yeah, probably. Or reused, because that's what they did for a long time. That's why
you gotta use those tapes.
That's why a lot of old Doctor Who is lost, because they BBC just reused the tape over it because they were cheap.
Also, there was a fire. One of the things happened was a fire.
Well, yeah, that too. Oh, but it's an Oscar thing. Do you know who who bought the distribution rights for this movie?
20th Century Fox.
New World Pictures.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, that's what it says. New World Pictures distributed.
Do you know
them.
Who found New World Pictures?
Chris
Roger
Columbus.
Corman.
Oh.
And Roger.
Well, that explains it, because on the on mm-hmm. Filmstruck, there's an interview with Roger Corman where he talks about how much he likes this movie.
And he apparently bought the rights to like some Truffaut movies and like some acclaimed like, you know, capital F, a film stuff.
Yeah.
In addition to his trashy nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah, he produced Schlock and he directed Schlock, but he also was a huge film nerd.
Yeah, and super cheap.
It's the same company who released The Student Nurses.
Oh, not sure if you've seen The Cars That Ate Paris.
No,
it's really good and interesting. He bought the rights to that, and on the projection booth episode where I talk about it, when I interview like the cast, the crew of like Bruce Spence from Mad Max 2, among other people, and a guy who played Napoleon and that movie you like with Keanu in it.
That movie I like with Keanu.
Bill and Ted. Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. And they interview some other actor from it. They all say Corman bought the rights and then held on to it as long as he could, and then stole the idea for Death Race 2000, because it came out a couple of years after he bought the rights to Cars That Ate Paris. And I think they have a case, but that's a story for another day.
Sure.
It's a good episode of Pressure Booth. Talk to Bruce Spence. It's awesome. Anyway.
I don't know what you're talking about. But Dersu Ozala was a good movie.
Yeah. I blame Corman for that side riff. Anyway, Dersu Ozala is a good. Okay, so I'm going to do something different this time and talk about the reviews up top.
Okay.
So the New York Times review from October 76. By Richard Eder. He thought it was disappointing and too repetitive. and he feels the second half with second half undoes all the good things that the first half did, but I think he's wrong about that.
Yep.
And the Guardian in 2012 did like a re-review or whatever, and 2012, yeah, and the shoot was 9 months long, and it was shot on location, which really shows, and kind of watching it, I was genuinely, like, some parts genuinely terrified, just because, like, how harsh Eastern Siberia can be.
Oh, yeah, it looked like a lot like Werner Herzog's Gary the Wrath of God.
Yeah, I wrote that in my notes. Remind me of that, yeah. And Fitzcarraldo.
Yeah. Like, they were really down there in it.
Yeah, they were.
In, like, the cold and in the, you know, that especially that one part where they're on the raft in the river. Yeah. It's just like.
Yeah, Kershaw was, like, he wasn't an old man yet, but he was in his 60s. And it's kind of like.
Yeah.
If I was in my 60s and making movies, I would not want to shoot in, like, the harsh Siberia at that age.
I get the feeling that this was his, like, real first opportunity to do whatever he wanted, as opposed to having Toho, like, you know, holding the whip, making sure he didn't go out of line.
I mean, he seemed to have free rein for a bit, kind of. Not complete free rein.
Yeah, you see what happened there.
Well, yeah. He flew too close to the sun, and, you know, his style kind of, I see it as his era was over because Ozu was dead, and Mizoguchi was dead, and Kimoshida was kind of, like, not as relevant, and so, like, I think it was this case of the old guard was going away, and they're like, he should go away, and for room for, like, Oshima, and I think Oshima was earlier on that. Anyway, that's my thinking on that.
And it wasn't them that would bring him back anyways. It was all these young filmmakers that had been watching his movies at film school or going to the theater to see them. Like, if you look in the IMDb Tribune trivia there, it says there's a shot that is very obviously inspired George Lucas when Luke is looking at the dual suns of Tatooine. There's a shot in here where you see the moon and the sun at the same time.
I didn't even think of that.
Well, Star Wars came out
77.
Yeah, 2 years after this movie was released.
So what have they been filming at this point?
So, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. But I also don't think, like, say George Lucas is in Tunisia. I don't think it's out of the question for him to, like, still be watching movies all the time and see something and be like, oh, man, the master is at it again, you know? Yeah. And obviously he loved Kurosawa, yeah. So he probably was like, I gotta go see this.
Yeah, probably. Let's see. Oh, according to TMC, they have Glug information on old movies. Kurosawa, when filming, he would listen to a lot of Harry Belafonte.
I mean, it's, didn't everyone?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, that was his music of choice during this shoot for some particular reason.
It work all day in the morning sun.
This is his only 70 millimeter film, and it's his only non-Japanese film.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I would love to see this in 70 millimeter projected. I would kill. Like, do you know somebody? I'll kill them.
I want Criterion to do an edition of this.
I mean, it's on Filmstruck. Is there not some sort of super fancy edition?
There was a DVD for $50, and I was like, fuck that. I'm just going to rent it on Amazon.
So, okay, let's talk about the differences between your version and my version.
My the Amazon rented version is dubbed. And, yeah.
So you had, I mean, could you hear the voices in the background also? Or was it, like, completely dubbed over?
At times, if there's, like, a lot of people on the scene, yeah, you would hear, like, some Russian in the background.
That's interesting. Yeah, and I watched it on Filmstruck, and it is the subtitled version, so they were speaking Russian, but, you know, I was reading the subtitles on the bottom, so that would suck if you had to watch a dub version. I'm sorry.
After 20 minutes, I got used to it, and then I wasn't liking it for, like, 20 minutes, because I thought there's only a version. I looked it up, and this movie was kind of hard to track down for a while.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't until, like, maybe 5 years ago, it got released on DVD, like, in a good edition.
And maybe that's what prompted that review from more recent that you read.
Probably.
Mm. Well, this is kind of a spectacular movie, and I don't feel like it's in the Kurosawa canon when people are talking about great Kurosawa movies. You know, they usually talk about his samurai work or his noirish
or
stuff.
Like, that's a forgotten one, too. Dreams.
What? Yeah, or The Last Things. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and when they talk about Rhapsody in August, they talk about how it's, you know, unfair to the Chinese.
Yeah, okay, one person talks about that.
Well,
one person at Cannes was like, this is stupid.
That's so fucking stupid.
You've been thinking about that since we talked about
it. Yeah, it makes me hate Cannes. Well, I didn't like Cannes to begin with, and now this, like, it just seems pretentious and dumb.
Yeah, I'm not into Cannes at all. Like, fuck that. What was the, like, format of the version you were watching? Was it, like, fit to screen, or did you have bars on the top
bars
and bottom?
Bars, top and bottom.
Okay, good. So did I.
Yeah. It's not a great quality version on Amazon.
What do you mean?
The film didn't look as good. Or maybe it's just the age of the film.
Yeah, if you're specifically talking about how the colors would, like, go red and like, blue and, like, flash back and forth, like, in scenes, like, I had that too. I think that's just the way it is.
No, you just think maybe it's like the Russian film was,
like, they took the whatever, the negative, and they didn't do any color corrections or something like that. You know, this is a movie that would, like, benefit from somebody taking the time to get a cinematographer who knows about Kurosawa's work, or possibly, you know, Russian film, and get in there and do some stuff with it. I mean, it looks really, I still think the movie really good.
This is, of the Kurosawa I've seen, this is, I think, the best looking one.
Yeah, out of the bunch that we've watched.
Because you see the, you see, like, all the seasons, and you see, like, this, the full scope of, you know, like, Russian nature.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's not just cinematography choices, like we were saying. He's out there. He's out there in the frickin' wilderness doing this filming, like, in weather conditions, like the wind blowing and stuff like that. I mean, I don't think any of that stuff was faked.
Yeah, I highly doubt it was faked, too. Yeah.
I really liked the sound design going on here. Mm-hmm. It's like he used everything, like the sound of them crunching in the snow as they're walking along. Like, at first I was like, that sounds weird. And then I had to, obviously I'm from Southern California, I don't really know what snow sounds like, but I was like, oh, that is what snow sounds like. I now I remember.
To me, it didn't seem.
It's got that weird, like, squeak.
Well, I'm used to snow because I don't live in Southern California. And yeah, it.
You don't?
No. I've never been to California at all.
Well, it sucks. Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, the snow thing I didn't really notice because over on the East Coast in the Mid-Atlantic, we're used to it.
It'd be snowing.
Yeah, we have something called seasons, Joel. Get used to it.
You got two seasons here.
Hot and too hot?
No, hot and cloudy. Oh.
Well, we have all the seasons here.
Oh.
Oh, on that topic, so you know how, so Russia is basically a landlocked country for the most part, and yeah. So that means it gets extremely cold, like negative 40, but it also means it gets extremely hot, and the summers can be like 125 degrees, nice. And so in the summer part, I just imagine it must have been like. Like this, really uncomfortable. Just given how hot Russian summers can get.
Yeah, I don't imagine the production was quite, you know, Fitzcarraldo, Aguirre, Rathgod, a level where the actors felt like they were being tortured. But they were actually, yeah, you could see them sweating. You could see how it'd be uncomfortable for what they were doing. And I can't imagine how many reshoots reshoots, but like, we need to do this scene again kind of thing.
Yeah. I
like that scene where Dirzu is on the raft and he has to jump off and grab that log or whatever. Like, there's no way they did that more than once. Really? I would be very surprised to find out they had to do, like, retakes.
I feel like if,
oh, you missed
if it was Kubrick, they'd do a couple retakes.
Oh, absolutely. He's got, like, seven rafts ready to go.
Yeah. Although Kubrick was kind of... Never mind. So you want to recap the movie? Although it's not really plot heavy, though.
Yeah. A bunch of Russian soldiers are out purveying an area in
Eastern
Siberia.
Eastern Siberia.
Basically. Yeah. And they run across a hunter named Dirzu Huzala and hire him as a guide. They're just basically navigating, they're mapping the area, looking for, you know, sites and stuff like that. And we follow them around through a harsh winter where the captain of this military group grows fonder and fonder of Dirzu. And they actually have a point where Dirzu and the captain have separated from the group when they were heading towards a lake, a frozen lake, and they end up getting lost because the wind has blown away their tracks. So there's a scene where they are quickly cutting as much long grass as they can because Dirzu, not explaining what he's doing, says that they need to do it. They need to quickly cut grass if they're going to live through the night. Otherwise, they'd freeze to death. And the captain faints. When he wakes up, they're inside of a hut that Dirzu has put together with the grass that they cut and the equipment that they brought in, weighing down, you know, pieces on the side using the thing that surveyors use?
I'd say a sextant, but that's something else.
Yeah, no, that is what it's supposed to be, a sextant. Yeah, using that as the center point and basically saving the captain's life.
Yeah, and this scene, like, you really get a sense that the actor playing the captain was actually on the verge of, like, fainting the entire time.
Yeah, he was super... I mean, he was exhausted from the work. They were freezing to death. The only reason Dirzu was able to, persevere is because he lived there. This was his home. You know, but he was sure that they could have frozen to death, too, either way. And luckily, he was, through quick thinking, was able to save both of them. Once the winter ends, Dirzu, the captain offers Dirzu to come back to town with him. Dirzu says no, you know, he wouldn't be able to get work in the city. He's gonna be hunting all these, sables. You know, it's just as good as money, he says.
What are sables?
So they part ways. They're like minks. Okay. They're like little fox animals.
Okay, I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, for fur.
Okay. Not for you mentioned, but Dirzu is an old man
Yeah, he's much older than the captain and the rest of the group. Looks but 70s
ish, maybe. Yeah. 60s, 70s.
And you can't really tell.
Yeah, but he has gray hair, and you can tell he's been there forever, basically.
Yeah, he's hunched over and stuff like that. And he, at least in my version, he speaks broken Russian, which is adorable.
Yeah, he spoke broken English in this one. That was annoying at first, but then you get used to it.
Yeah, I think it would have come off a lot better if you were reading, like I said. But, you know, at first, the captain's men are making fun of him, like, because he's doing things like he'll say, there's people over there. And like, what people? Like, a boar. Like, he thinks of animals and plants as people also. He thinks they're all of the same thing, which is actually something I kind of think about, but that's besides the point.
Yeah, and like, he... I forgot where I was going with that.
Well, he seems incompetent, just like because he's an older man and stuff like that. And when they first find him, he hasn't eaten for a while, but he shows himself to be more than competent at certain things that the soldiers assume they're better at. Like he's an excellent shot. He can track things. He looks at a track and he's like, "Oh, this is a track of an old man," and they're like, "How?" How can you say that's an old man? He's like, well, a young man walks with their toes. An old man walks on their heels, and they like follow the tracks in it. Sure enough, there's an old man up there.
Yeah.
Hey, old man, what's up?
Yeah, and the moment where they start respecting, where the men start respecting him is when they're shooting a bottle, and then I think like five of them miss, and then Dursu is like.
I mean, they're not just shooting a bottle. They've tied a bottle to a tree, and they're swinging it from a rope. So it's a moving target.
Yeah, and then Dursu is like, well, if I can shoot the rope, then I want that bottle. And they're like, okay, sure. And in one shot, he shoots a rope. And they're like, oh, this is more than just a goofy old man. He's actually a... Yeah.
Yeah. He's our better in this case, yeah. So the captain and his group of soldiers part way from Dursu, and later in the spring of the next year,
it's 5 years
the captain
later.
Returns. Oh, is it 5 years later?
Yeah, the first year is it's winter 1902. It's spring 1907.
Oh man, I could have sworn it said it was like the next year. No, you're right. 5 years later, 1907.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he comes back in the springtime this time with a new group of soldiers, basically on the same job. They're mapping the land. And the captain's hoping that he'll run into Dursu, but it's been such a long time, he assumes that he's probably dead. But luckily, one of the soldiers sees an old man, an old hunter, and the captain runs off, and there's Dursu. You know, it's like seeing your old friend. It's great. It's actually really touching.
It's one of my favorite Kershaw moments.
Mm-hmm. That part after they survive, that winter storm, you know, in that hut, and they shoot in the air, and the people fire back to indicate that they know they're there. They're like, you know, we're gonna be found, and they're like rustling on the ground. It's like that. That's really funny.
I was going to say earlier, during the winter storm, I think, pretty sure it's where the sound design gets real David Lynch-y, with like that constant running a eraser head, because the music gets very uneasy, and there's like a constant like wind blowing noise aside from the wind, kind of like a, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I feel like he added that to make it more like unearthly and like you know, terrifying,
dire.
Yeah, and like that scene is genuinely one of the scariest scenes I've seen in a movie.
I like the way it's done. I do have an issue with it though. Should I just get into that now?
Sure.
I know that the captain was going to be fine, Because in the beginning of this movie, we see him going to visit Dirzu's grave, which he can't locate because a town has been built and the location was buried. So I didn't really feel like there were any stakes in that. No. Like, he's not going to die. We see him in the future. And I think that was a mistake.
I guess, but still the whole being a winter storm thing was just...
I mean, no, it's a great scene. Like, if you cut out that beginning part, I might even have been like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Is one of them going to die? But, yeah, I just assumed that neither were going to. Definitely not the captain. Just a nitpick. Like, it doesn't really take away from the movie.
Not really.
So, anyways, Dirzu and him join back up again, and they're navigating the area. I forgot. There's that one part. There's a part where they like find a hut with some native people that live there, and they're frying fish. I was like, hey, I'm gonna get some fried fish.
Oh yeah,
what's going on there, guys?
It did look pretty good.
Yeah.
Hospitality. Nanai. That's it.
Yeah.
I think Dirzu is Nanai. No, he's Goldie. Is it Goldie?
And that's
Goldie.
I have no idea.
I'm not sure how you say it.
Goldie is what he is. He is a Aboriginal Goldie.
Yeah, that's it. Because that could... Well, I can get into that later. But anyways.
Yeah. But that scene where he meets those people and they basically invite the four soldiers that are there into the hut to eat. And the scene where they find an older Chinese gentleman and they share food with him and stuff like that. And the respectfulness he's showing for like the forest, like showing the tracks and stuff like that is just, it sets the, how, like the example of how different it is, like living in this forest. And we finally get a comparison later in the movie is like what it's like in the city. And it's really quite effective. So Dirzu and the captain and this new group of goofballs are all navigating. Like I said, they're just walking through this beautiful forest now because it's no longer winter. It's spring, and then it goes into summer. And Dirzu is shooting at somebody, although it's off screen, and he comes back. And they're like, who are you shooting at? He's like, well, some people put some holes in my clothes, so I was going to put some holes in their clothes. And it turns out there's bandits. So there's kind of inconsequential offshoot thing where they go to try to get these bandits, and they find these three men who have been tied up into a river, to execute them. They rescue these three guys. And some other soldiers show up in the field. There's almost a firefight, but Dirzu recognizes them as not being bandits. And I almost thought it was going to end up with them like going out to go hunt these bandits together. But basically the other army is like, we'll take care of this. There's not that many of them. Like, oh, yeah, okay.
And they all know Dirzu pretty well.
And it's not, it's like not a thing. It's like, once again, we're showing that out here, things are different than they would be like on a modern battlefront or something like that. It's like, yes, this trusted man, if he trusts you, then we can trust you also. Like that much is true and evident. It's like, if we say we don't need your help, he doesn't put up a protest or anything like that. He's like, okay.
Yeah, cool. It makes me think of the way, quote unquote, Ethiopians were seen by the Romans. Because the Romans respected... The Egyptians respected the Ethiopians, which basically is code for Africans that aren't from Egypt, because the Romans and Greeks didn't really care enough to go that deep in Africa. So any dark-skinned African was an Ethiopian. But the Romans and Greeks really respected the other Africans because the Egyptians really respected them.
Yeah.
Oh, so if you read like the ancient Greek plays or poems or like the Odyssey or whatever, and you see Ethiopian, it just means a dark skin.
African, not from Egypt.
It doesn't mean Ethiopia. I think it's in the Bible, too.
Interesting.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Probably.
So that's... sorry. That's one of the many events that happen in this movie that are kind of just showing what's going on, because Sterzu is guiding these people through. They find these huge stacks of just, like, bushes and wood that have been specifically put into place so that an animal that's heading towards a river has to walk down a path where there are traps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Derzu is not happy about this. He feels like it's disrespectful, especially when they find out that there are animals in the pits that have been laid that have been dead for a long time. Like, he feels it is just a waste.
Yeah, I believe it's when he says the... No, it's earlier when he talks about the Chinese, because he says, like, only the Chinese kill for no reason.
And the Russians.
Yeah. But, like, he makes the point that, like, they would kill an animal just to kill it, where he's like, they're not going to even use it, which is a perfectly valid viewpoint.
Only a Sith speaks in absolutes. No, yeah. That's not true. Everybody does. Yeah. And they're, let's see, basically wind up to another scene where they are navigating a river. I don't remember how they end up in this situation, but they're like,
yeah, it's not, I don't remember either.
I don't think it's important, but they're on a raft going down a river. And I guess the river is getting to the point where they can't control where it's going. Like it's heading towards a falls or something like that. So most of the soldiers are running alongside the bank. The captain and Derzu are on the raft, and Derzu pushes the captain off to get him off before they end up in a worse situation. And then Derzu is riding the raft and he jumps off, but he can't jump into the water and try to swim because the current's too strong. He grabs onto a tree that's been sunken into the water. And then the Russian soldiers have to cut down a tree and use their belts to basically float out this tree that they cut down to Derzu so that he can climb back from the water onto the shore. The whole time he's yelling at them and they're yelling back and forth trying to get this done.
Yeah, real quick. He tells them right tree to cut down too.
Yeah. It's just one of those, yeah. It's just a scene in the movie, which it's really well done.
Yeah, it's really, it's almost as scary as the winter storm.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody's involved in this one. as we're winding down towards the end, there is a point where Derzu hears a tiger. I can't remember what he's calling it. He's calling it something else.
Yeah, it's like a forest spirit thing. I can't remember the name, but like
it's like Amada or something. Adama?
I can't remember.
General Adama.
I didn't write it down.
Oh well. Let's see. And eventually they do run into a tiger out in the wild. And Derzu and the captain are standing there with their guns ready. But Derzu fires at the tiger. And he's absolutely sure that he hit it. And the captain's like, well, he ran away. And Derzu's like, tiger runs away until it dies. That's how it does it. You know? And this is, like, devastating to him. Like, it changes his entire attitude. He's no longer
jovial,
kind or anything like that. He's very criticizing of anything cruel or mean that the soldiers might do inadvertently. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a point where one of the soldiers throws some meat into the fire, and he's like, why would you throw meat, perfectly good meat, into the fire? You should leave it in case another person comes along. And like, what person? Like the badger, the wolverine, all these other things that could come and eat. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene later where Nderzu, actually, the captain and Nderzu have walked off, and captain sees Nderzu smells a boar. He can smell that there's a boar nearby. And the captain can't. He sees it, though.
Mm-hmm.
And he opens fire at the boar and misses. But Nderzu says, I couldn't see what you were shooting at. Like, his eyes start to fail on him. And it's, you know, he's, of course, thinking that it's all related to him having shot this tiger. And this is the forest spirits, you know, getting their revenge on him. And eventually, Nderzu is just distraught. He thinks that he's going to die. He doesn't want to be here where the forest wants to kill him. And he agrees to come back to the city where the captain lives, the city of Khabarovsk.
Yep.
Khabarovsk?
It's something Russian.
I'm just getting used to speaking Japanese terms. You know, you want me to do Russian? What the hell?
Yeah, it's, well, it's kind of a Mongol-inspired name because the KH
famous. Right.
Yeah.
It says in Chinese, it is pronounced pinyin. No, wait, no. Oh, man, this was a mistake looking at the Wikipedia page. I'm just going to go back. So Nderzu is living with the captain's family. You know, we see the captain's wife and his young child, his young son. And everybody is growing attached to Nderzu, but it's very obvious that Nderzu is not happy.
Yeah, he spends most of the time just staring at the fireplace.
Hmm. And they have, like, a Victrola that they are, like, recording voices on, and they record Nderzu talking about how he just stares at the fire. There's no animals here. There's no need for a hunter. All this stuff like that. And regular everyday city things happen, and Nderzu is just infuriated by it. Like, a man comes by and delivers the water that they need, probably to drink. And Derzu's like, why is this man charging you for water? You can get water from the river. Like, this doesn't make any sense to him, because everything that you could need is for free in where he comes mm-hmm. from, you know? And he wants to go out shooting, you know, because out in the forest, he could just shoot wherever he wanted to. But you can't do that in a city. You know, people get scared. And he's a stranger there.
And they'd probably assume he's trying to kill them because he's, you know, not a white person.
Exactly. Yeah. And the final straw is Nderzu sees that the captain's wife is paying for firewood. So he goes off and cuts down a tree in one of the local parks and gets arrested because of that. And Nderzu begs the captain to please let him go back to the forest. He can't live here, mm-hmm. you know, the way that he has been living. And everyone's sad about it. The son is really close to Nderzu at this point. The wife also cares for him. And the captain gives him a brand new gun as, like, a parting gift. Like, it's the newest model.
Yeah, and it has, like, improved sights, so it'll be good. So it'll help him, you know, still shoot.
Yeah. Even if he can't see, he says you'll hit every time. And Nderzu leaves. And that's basically where we get a very quick ending. The next thing we see is a letter on screen saying that the body of a
goalie.
The body of a goalie. Goldie. Right?
Yeah, Goldie. Yeah,
whatever. Has been found, and he had your information on it. Please come identify. So the captain goes down to an area right next to the train tracks where Goldie would have got on either the track mm-hmm. closest to his home. And sure enough, somebody has killed Nderzu and taken his gun. and they're just going to bury him in this unmarked grave. You know, they're very upsettingly, you know, brief about it. Like, I just need you. You've identified him? Okay, I need you to sign these papers.
Yeah, the guy's being a real jerk and not giving the captain, you know, a moment to, like, clearly the captain is upset and the guy just does not care because he, you know, just wants to hurry up and go, I don't know, identify other bodies or whatever.
Yeah, he's just a dead nobody, so why would anybody be upset about it?
Well, I think it's just also some racism of, like, oh, he's just a dead native. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, probably. But they don't really actually go into any racism in the movie.
Well, there's one point.
It could be presumed.
Yeah, there's one point where someone called him a savage. The water man.
It didn't happen in my version. He just said, what, are you crazy? No,
in my version, like, he called him, like, a stupid savage.
Insert racism. That's the weird thing about translations. Like, you're never going to know unless you actually speak the language what they're saying. I think that all the time in, like, musical parts in movies where they're translating the text and they, like, make it rhyme in English. I'm like, that's not what they're saying. I guarantee it. Mm. But whatever.
Yeah, so... Yeah, Dursley was killed in basically by the modern world.
Yep. Unceremoniously on his way home, but he'd already predicted that he was as good as dead, whether he was in the forest or the city anyways. But it is just, frankly, sad. The last thing we see is the captain taking Dursley's walking stick and putting it into his unmarked grave. You know, we don't even flash back to the beginning part where he was looking for this thing. It's just, he's forgotten except for what the captain knows. And luckily, like you said, it's based on a true story. So there are, like, actual photographs of this guy and the captain.
Yeah, the captain was a real person. And he wrote a memoir about Dursu in his time with Dursu.
It's called My Left Foot.
Yeah, I think. It has a bunch of different translations. Like, one is Dursley the Trapper. A bunch of stuff. I actually want to read it after watching this. I'm sure it's good.
Yeah, I want to track down that Russian version, if I can. That, the movie that came out previously, and see what that's all about.
But, this movie was this kind of... real heartbreaking.
Yeah, it had a heartbreaking ending, but I do find that the whole movie on a whole was more inspiring than anything. Like, you feel like you could be in touch with nature the way he is. Mm-hmm. You could see why somebody would think city life is flawed. Like, it doesn't make any sense in the context of, like, no, seriously, if I need something, the world is providing it for me. I don't have to wait for somebody to bring it to me. Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's a hippie movie.
Well, I mean, it's based off a book from the 20s. So.
Yeah.
Everything you think is new is actually way older than you realize.
Exactly.
Yeah. To me, I said earlier, this is the most beautiful Kurosawa movie, in my opinion. Mm. And, it feels like every 5 minutes there would be a shot that could easily be a painting. Like, it was so...
Yeah, the environment they're in is, like, absolutely gorgeous. And imagine what it looked like in the 20s. Like, it probably looked even different than what it did 70s. In the 70s when they shot this.
Yeah, like, this... Like, there's a... Like, even the brutal, blizzard snowstorm... And, like, even that, like, shots at this would look like a beautiful painting. And there's this shot of them looking at the sky, and the moon and the sun are both on screen. And just everything was arranged.
I mean, that's just gorgeous. That is 100%. Like, yeah, seriously, take that frame, make a painting, you're done.
Yeah, I love the campfire scenes because I'm pretty sure it's natural light where you would just see, like, in one, it was all the men at one campfire site, and then this darkness around them, and then in the other corner, it was a Sturzo and the captain. And it was just this beautifully framed.
It's probably not actual natural light. It's probably, but very close.
Well, some scenes, I'm sure they had to use natural light.
Yeah, I'm sure. Campfire stuff would be very difficult to get without making the film look all grainy.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I mean, I doubt it was like Barry Lyndon. Have you seen Barry Lyndon?
No, but, I mean, if it's like his other stuff.
Barry Lyndon was all natural light.
No, yeah, I did not know that.
Kubrick.
So it's like Dogma 95 before Dogma 95?
Kubrick insisted that all of the movie is natural light.
That's cool.
Or candle light. Like, nothing.
Yeah,
it's, and you watch it, it's my favorite Kubrick movie. But that's a search for another thing. It's underrated.
I heard it's boring.
No.
But some people might say this movie's boring, which I would think you're a crazy person.
Yeah, the criticism that the second half undoes the first half, I think is stupid, because I think it's supposed to be, it's structured to be the same, but Derzu is getting older, and it's supposed to be about him just not being able to live the life he wants to live anymore. And like, it repeats on purpose. It's not like laziness the way like some critics at the time viewed it.
I think it's a complete story, and it's really well done. I think it's kind of epic. It's not really like an epic in what I think of as that, but I think it's masterclass.
Yeah. The Guardian reviewer, Philip French, called it a humanist masterwork.
Who's that guy?
He writes for The Guardian.
I don't like him. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but like, some review I saw, might have been New York Times, no, was it? I think Variety at the time called it like his most epic and most intimate movie. Which makes sense if you see it.
You know, we haven't scraped all the stuff that's going on beforehand. Like, I think I would have to literally see everything he did before this in order to weigh in on that particular opinion.
That's what one reviewer said about it.
Right.
But,
I can do a fancy talk.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of, like, Fitzcarraldo, as we said earlier. And there are a couple scenes, I forgot what scene? I can't remember what scene it was, but there's something that made me think of the pulling the ship over the mountain.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't nearly, you know, as insane.
Right, it's not as arduous. Yeah.
Which, if you haven't seen Fitzcarraldo, I think it's worth it just for the whole, like, section of trying to pull a full-size ship over a mountain, and they do it, and it's insane.
Yeah.
Let's see. So, I think to understand this movie more, you gotta understand some historical context of, like, the native Russians, and like, Russian history isn't really taught in American schools, really. But after, like, the age of Genghis Khan and his grandson Kublai Khan, like, the lesser Khans after that, Khan is a title, actually. It means universal ruler. Anyway, the later people in the family tree, because they spread out, because they were everywhere, they had this massive army called the Golden Horde that conquered what we now call Russia. And so Russia was for about, I think was 600 years or so, they were this a subject of the Mongol Empire. And so in Russia, there's a lot of, so basically the Russian people came from like the, from like the Vikings, the Eastern Europeans, and like the Mongols and descendants of like Genghis Khan. And so that's why like the native Russians look Mongolian.
Right.
Yeah, and that thing was Ivan the Third who finally freed Russia from the Golden Horde, and Ivan the Third's Ivan the Great, and he's Ivan the Terrible's great grandfather. Yeah. No, grandfather? His grandfather. Yeah, I got it. Because his father was Vasily the Third. And may not actually have been his father because his mom was sleeping around. Anyway.
Somebody.
I know some Russian history, as you can tell.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Ivan the Terrible is Ivan the Fourth, in case you're wondering. And Terrible is a mistranslation. Well, it's really Ivan Grozny, which means Ivan the Formidable. Yeah, I see. Just a simple issue, yeah.
And which one of them became the boxer that Rocky has to fight?
That's a different family. He's not from the Rorik family, but I don't want to talk about Russian history. Anyway, Rorik was the founder of the original Russian peoples, and he was a Viking, and he was a tall redhead.
What about them Romanovs?
They came, well, Rorik was 1800 CE. Romanovs took power with Mikhail Romanov in the 1630s, 1640s. Because the Rorik family died out with Ivan's son, Fyodor.
All right, stop your nerding.
I didn't even get into the whole thing of the false Dmitri.
So, how do you feel this movie compares to the other Kurosawa that we've watched?
Okay, so, it reminds me of Rhapsody in August, and that's about, you know, an old person and the end of their life.
Right, and it is personal, the way that that person was saying that this movie is, where it's about these people on a small scale talking to, or while a big thing is basically being experienced.
Yeah, it's
like, yeah,
it's very personal. It's a huge epic movie in terms of like the physical scope of it, but the emotional like core of it is a friendship between Dersu and the captain. And it's very, right, like, to put it lightly, very endearing and very touching. And it's not like old mystic insert minority here. It's like they are equals. Like, Dersu is actually, you know, like, seen as an equal to all the Russians.
Yeah, he is not treated poorly in a way that you might think would happen. The only other one out of the ones that we've watched for the show that I would compare it to is The Men Who Tread on the Tiger's Tail. Just because of the, you know, it's a group of people on a journey.
Oh, okay.
They walk through a bunch of foresty areas and stuff like that.
This has an actual tiger.
And it's also based on a previous material.
Yeah. I forgot to mention this in other episodes, but the Benkei character from Tiger's Tail, the main guy.
Benkei?
Is it Benkei?
Oh.
Remember?
I don't remember.
He has big eyebrows, the bald guy.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about. I don't remember his name.
Anyway, that role is like considered to be in like kabuki in Japanese theater, cause it's supposed to be like the best role you can get. It's like being able to play like Hamlet in Hamlet. Like, it's the, you know, it's a huge deal if you get to play a character in the Kabuki play.
Oh, it's like being able to play Dr. Frankenfurter in Rocky Horror Picture Show.
It's like that big of a deal.
Nice.
Yeah, that's it.
That was completely unrelated.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that for, like, I don't know, 6 months.
Yeah, yeah, no. It feels like we've seen a lot of Kurosawa movies, and maybe somebody might think we have, but we really are just, we're not even halfway through his library. I mean,
well, so this is the eighth or ninth?
Oh, man, I just had the list up, and then you asked that. Of course, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yes, this is the 8th one.
So we have 20-something left.
They haven't even done some of the metal-known ones, like Ran, Ikiru, Throne of Blood, Our Namesake.
Yeah, that's that'll show up eventually.
Sure.
Yeah, well, Ikaru is one of the most famous ones, and it's I'm saving that one for later, especially.
Oh, did Aaron Cornelius tell you that he wanted to be on the Hidden Fortress episode?
No, he did not, but I do want him on it.
Okay, that's he really wants to be on it.
Because it's Star Wars? Okay.
Yes.
Of course.
So we'll have to figure that out when that
gets
around.
Yeah, that's a famous one, though, so.
Well, we're going to be doing Ozu special pretty soon,
yes,
too, right?
Yes, in the next month-ish.
Early summer? Is that the one? That's a really good one I've seen
before. I think I've seen it. I'm pretty sure I have.
And it's got Setsuko Hara.
I have seen it, then.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I mean, she's in a couple of, she's in, let's see,
she's
1, 2, 3, 4. 5. She's at least 6. She's in 6 other. Or 6. Yeah, at least.
And she's in
Tokyo Story, Late Spring, Late Autumn, Tokyo Twilight.
Yeah, she's in one Kurosawa, which is No Regret for You.
The Idiot.
She's an idiot? Oh, I guess she's in 2.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so we'll be finally getting to some Ozu soon-ish. So, yeah, next episode is going to be Sundaken number 8 from 1975, I guess.
Yeah, who we got lined up for that?
Someone by the name of G-Rad CC, a.k.a.
G-Rad CC.
Or G-Rad CC's Pizza, a.k.a. Okay. Gina Radcliffe from Kill by Kill.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, everyone's favorite super cool aunt is going to stop by.
She was on our Jigoku, a.k.a. Gates of Hell episode.
It's called Gates of Hell?
Yes, in fact, I think that's what it's more commonly known as.
Hmm. Yeah, so Gina's going to come back.
Oh, sorry, the Sinners of Hell. Not. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Gina will be back next episode. And, yeah, so this, actually 75, has a couple big movies that came out that year, so it might be a little longer episode, too.
That's cool. Talking about, you mean like the other movies that came out that year?
Yeah, 75 had a couple huge things come out.
Oh, yeah. I'm just looking at it now, including the one we were just talking about, which is interesting. Cool, dude.
Yeah. So, yeah, plugs.
If you don't find my voice irritating, you can hear me every Monday on a new episode of Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, where me and my co-hosts Sarah and Aaron talk about a new science fiction or fantasy movie. I mean, not new. I mean, like, they're new episodes. For instance, this week we just recorded an episode on the movie Hellboy, which is going to be a lot of fun because one of us did not like that movie, and I'm going to get them to talk about that. Other things we recently covered, RoboCop, you know, the classics, Gremlins.
And some movie from the 50s, something black and white or something.
I don't know what you're talking about. We only do
it's
cool
about seals,
movies.
And there's 7 of them.
Oh, yeah, the 7 Navy SEALs. Yes, we also did the 7th SEAL, if you're looking for some classical education, something more in tune with this podcast. We did Stalker a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to hear us being dumbfounded by a movie, thanks to Spencer. Yeah.
Oh, Thirsty reminds me of Stalker a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that.
But for sure. It's more coherent, more clear.
Yes, absolutely. It's not... I also think Stalker is better looking, but not by much.
I need to watch Stalker again.
No, you don't.
Okay.
Just take some acid and go to the theme park.
Sure. I'm going to Disney in a couple months. I'll do that.
There you go. Yeah, ride Star Tours seven
Disney
times.
Disney World, the good one, not your California one.
What? Disney World sucks. Disneyland rules.
It's the same thing.
Probably. I've never been.
Yes. Oh, yeah. My plugs. Semi Knife Fight this month is June, and it's my birthday month. And it's because my birthday month, that means I cover my favorite TV show, The Twilight Zone. And it's Jess Fell from season 4. And it's one of the two good episodes from season 4, which kind of sucks. If you're going to watch Twilight Zone, skip that season, except for this one episode, Jess Fell. And, what?
Spencer, this is also my birthday month, so you're going to have to cover my favorite TV show, which is Hannibal.
Okay, sure. It's a little too recent, and I'm not a fan.
You make me
sick. I saw the first
seven
episodes, and then I was like, that's not for me.
I need you to go take a long walk off a short pier immediately.
Okay. But, yeah, so someone I fight, what else? Oh, and a couple months, I'll be on the Grindbin podcast. It's a podcast on schlocky B movies from the 60s to the 90s. It's L.A. based, so you might know the guys. Probably not. Anyway.
Yeah, I know those
Grindbin.
Guys.
Do yeah. you?
They live right over there.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I'm going to be talking about the movie Coonskin by Ralph Bakshi. Because that's a fascinating, very misguided movie that I kind of really like because it's so weird and misguided.
Sounds good
you
to me.
You would hate it because Ralph Bakshi, and it's this kind of uncomfortable in a lot of ways.
If it's not, yeah, I probably won't watch it.
I thought of doing that for when I guest on your show, but it'd just be an awkward episode because it's a really awkward movie in just so many ways. It's his.
Okay, we'll talk about that off air because I got an idea of how that'll fit
Coonskin.
In.
Coonskin? Okay. Yes. Yeah, so hashtag thug life, hashtag knock it eye forever. Nakadai still alive. He's going to show up on the podcast again soon. I'm not sure when, but he will.
Pineapple party?
Yep, pineapple party.
Should I embrace the pineapple party?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, there's something deviant about it.
Whatever, hashtag thug life. Auf Wiedersehen.
Yep, bye. Thanks for listening.
See ya. You can email our show at highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. Please rate and review wherever you listen to or find our podcast. Art, the logo is by Aaron Cornelia, and the theme song is by David DeRoy. Thank you for listening.
A sippy cup to keep a cap on all the screaming of songs. What happens when the drink is gone? Nothing stuffing down a stifled little yell. Desperation down, numbly at night. I pray to learn to pretend so I can sleep tight. But something doesn't feel right. Makes me think that I could change too.